Welcome to the pod, everyone. Bit of a shout out to SGS, who myself and Fletch are going to do a little bit of work with. Hopefully make it the most innovative, impactful, effective coaching qualification in the country, industry ready, experiential, backed up with all the science and the evidence stuff. And just a brief word from them beforehand.
SGS College is the home of Bristol's higher education sports programmes. The programmes are designed to develop unique, innovative and creative sports practitioners ready for industry. Do you want to be a coach or teacher of the future? Start your journey here at SGS College and become more than just a graduate. Visit sgscol.ac.uk to apply now.
Cool, welcome to the pod. I feel like I haven't done one in ages, actually. Cody Royal, how are you doing?
Rusty, I am fantastic, mate. Thanks for having me. Have you had an Aussie Rules coach on before?
We've had a few Australians on. Have we had Aussie Rules on? No. We've had some people who live in Canada, so you have that in common. We've had some people who have written books, so you've got that in common as well. Trying to think what else. But no, we haven't. But, mate, look, thanks for coming on the show. It originally started out with me chasing down Pete Carroll, and connecting with you, and then actually me thinking, why haven't I invited Cody on? Because you're doing some pretty cool stuff. So, mate, welcome aboard. First AFL coach we've ever had. Do you want to kind of tell people your story? What's got you to this point?
Sure. I coach Canada's men's AFL program. So... believe it or not, even though AFL is only played professionally in Australia, there are many, many countries that have both men's and women's programs up and going. So it's been really cool to move halfway around the world and be able to be involved in footy still. My journey took me through the elite player pathways. So I played for the Oakley Chargers in Melbourne, which is where kind of most of my friends got drafted and I didn't. And that led me into coaching at a pretty early age. At 23, I was when I first got behind the whistle. And I kind of merged those two together in that where I really wanted to focus as a coach was on the elite players. So having kind of gone through that pathway and understood, I thought I could associate with them, especially when I was quite young, you know, 23, and I was coaching 16, 17, 18 year olds, and I'd just been through that same pathway. But then even moving over here and getting to work with the better Canadian born players with the national team was just really where my passion led. I don't actually like teaching the game. I like teaching players once they have a certain level of excellence, I think I can make them better. So that's where I focused my attention.
Nice, you're polishing.
Exactly, yeah, exactly.
Although interestingly, in Canada, like I imagine some of those players haven't played that much AFL. And I think we chatted earlier about it. Well, there wouldn't be that many sports in Canada that involve kicking a ball. You might kick a puck, I guess.
There aren't many.
I would imagine there's a little bit of teaching the game going on.
There is. Yeah, it's the great thing is most of them are elite athletes at something else, and so they have that mindset and mentality. So I honestly think the skill or the passing by foot is a big issue to overcome in that most don't grow up with that like we do in Australia. However, I think the biggest barrier to entry is the physicality of the sport and the 360 nature of it. So, for instance, rugby players who have played at a high level here, either in NCAA or U Sports, they might struggle in Aussie Rules just with the ability to be able to be tackled from 360 degrees around them. So their spatial awareness might be off, but I still see the physicality and the being hit and having to get back up and then run 100 yards to tackle someone else as being the biggest barrier. So most of the Canadians come with that to me because they've played hockey or rugby or something and they love the physicality. So I can teach them the skills, but you can't really teach that mindset.
Yeah, interesting. That the rugby coaches I know over there would say a pretty similar story. Lots of players that are involved in other sports come into rugby, of course, often a little bit later, really excited about smashing into other people, quite frankly. Love the physicality. And then actually quite like, and similar-ish with some of the stuff you spoke about earlier, quite like the reality that they can go and play in a club, because club sports in North America isn't the same as like, you know, Australia or the UK. Well, it doesn't exist that much, does it?
No, not at all. In fact, rugby is probably the one that actually has that heritage. Rugby and cricket, really, in Canada especially, where they're probably the few sports that have succeeded in getting that club mentality to stick. Whereas, yeah, hockey and basketball becomes pickup. So you just go and you might rent an hour on the rink and just you try to get some mates down with some beers. But it's not the real, you know, we represent this club, which I found bizarre when I first got here. But, you know, part of it is just the valuation of time and time outside, because we live in Canada. You might only get 3 months of summer. And so, you know, people want to go and do things. And sometimes that's go and be on the lake with their dad or mum or wife or girlfriend. And so, yeah, they're pretty happy to do that as well, which I understand.
Yeah, no, I get excited when I come to Canada in January because it's about minus 30 and I get to see lots of snow. Although I'm equally excited when I leave about 12 days later, because I'll go to some kind of temperature where humans can exist normally.
Rusty, I hadn't seen snow until I got here. I was a 25-year-old man and I'd never seen snow.
And you're just catching up now. You've seen plenty, I would imagine.
Seen plenty, yeah. I've seen it above my head on the side of the street, which is also quite bizarre for an Australian who's used to living in positive temperatures.
Nice. And what about, tell me about what's been the best moments with the Canadian AFL team. What have you loved? What's been your highlights?
There's a couple of things, mate. It's one is the camaraderie that comes with having people represent their country. It's in our sport, especially again, because it's only played professionally in Australia, it doesn't really exist. They have the international rules with the Gaelic guys, but it's not really a natural part of our game. So to see these guys from Vancouver to Halifax, right the way across the country, all come together and, you know, probably for the first time in their lives get to put a maple leaf on their chest. It just brings this added element to Aussie rules that I just love, and getting to, yeah, give someone their jersey for the first time is one of the most brilliant things ever. I know you've been involved in the international scene as well, so I know you know what I'm talking about here, just how special that is. And for it to happen in our sport is really, really cool. And then just to see the game grow, see the women's team thrive as well, and just see Aussie rules literally on the other side of the world be up and going and so many people involved has been just magic.
Nice. What a beautiful description. And do Australia win the world championships every year? Is there a world champ? And does Australia always win?
They don't get to play, which is advantageous. So it's the International Cup happens every 3 years. So our cycle is triannual, and there's about, I think there was about 25 countries go in 2017. So, I mean, the teams that have won probably won't shock people. It's New Zealand, Papua New Guinea and Ireland mostly. Their Aussie rules infrastructure is just miles ahead of anyone else, but the US and GB and us are kind of knocking on that door, and we're coming for them. And in both the men's and the women's side, there's it's going to be exciting watching footy in the next 15 to 20 years. It's on TV in the States. It's going bananas over here as well. So our participation will probably increase. And it's just access to it. And you know this, like the level of athlete in North America is just insane. And so if we can get them into Aussie rules at 23 instead of 28, the US and Canada are going to be something pretty special.
Yeah, the US sevens team in particular, I mean, the ability to take guys who are genetically gifted everywhere else in the world, but managed to be surplus to requirements in America, is pretty mind-blowing for me. I love what you said about the show presentation. Actually, thinking a bit about how often as a coach you can you can maybe forget how important that is for players. I've been lucky to be involved in a few. 2013, before the World Cup, so I'm sure some of the lads will be listening, was we were either going to lose every game at the World Cup or do pretty well, because the emotion in the room was like mind-blowing. And I never really thought about it till you said it then, that we were simply handing over shirts and telling each other what we valued about each other. And grown men were weeping for about 30 minutes.
Yeah, we had a similar thing, or I've been involved in a couple of those. And why it's extra special, Rusty, is that it's when you play for a club or another representative team, you know, your province or county or whatever, it's still not quite at that level. But when you get to the national level, the knock-on effect, because everyone's thinking about, my mum is going to be so proud, my dad is going to be so proud, you know, my granddad's been having a hard time with his health and he's going to be just so, whatever it may be, whatever this person's story is, the fact that they get to say that they've played for their country at anything, even Aussie rules football, is it's just at another level.
No, it's not even Aussie rules, especially in Aussie rules.
Especially in Aussie rules, yeah, exactly. Well, if you can find a sport and become an international player, you know, in your 20s or 30s, yeah, hey, you deserve the jersey, man.
I'm going to coach the England under-35 women's touch team next year. And they rang me up to ask me to do it. And they were like, they were really worried that I might not say yes. I'm like, what? Wow, how cool is that? Like, it's amazing type stuff. But even for coaches, you know, it's like, it's pretty exciting, isn't it? Going to coach some people to represent their country.
It's one of the best things that's happened to me. And, you know, I actually wanted to, I was telling Chris Fagan this, who coaches the Brisbane Lions. He's kind of one of the first AFL coaches who didn't have a, you know, pretty prestigious playing background. And I said to him, I actually wanted that job. Like, I wanted to be the first guy that didn't get drafted into the AFL to coach. So you took my role. But being involved in the national program was just fortuitous. I kind of fell into it, but geez, I'm glad I did, because of that, like seeing guys represent their country and me representing Canada with them as an expat. Yeah, there's something truly special about it, even when it's your adopted country.
Nice. Maybe you'll be the second.
Maybe I'll be the second. I'll be the first former Canadian coach that also didn't get drafted into the AFL.
Yeah, nice. And that's, so this is this your, I mean, this is this a hobby really? Because your proper job, talking about this coaching malarkey, your proper job is like writing books and doing stuff around leadership. Do you want to kind of bring that to life?
Yeah, so all of these things have come together for me really nicely. I'm a writer by trade. So, you know, I help companies with their content development, specifically in what's called user experience or UX. So how human beings interact with technology. And so I consult with that. I also, you know, consult a few coaches and teams around leadership and coaching. And then I also, yeah, write. So I wrote a book called Where Others Won't, and that led to a podcast called Where Others Won't, which is just all about leadership. So I have this nice little world going where I coach and write about coaching and learn about coaching, even in my kind of day job. And so, yeah, you know, human performance and human development is kind of what I, you know, jump between on a day-to-day basis. So the great thing is, especially with something as simple as writing or language, is just how applicable it is to what you and I do on a daily basis with our teams anyway. And so being entrenched in that has really shot my PD forward in a big way.
No, that's what I was going to ask you. So what's the connections between coaching and UX and, you know, and UX and coaching? What's going both ways?
So do you remember when, you'll be old enough to remember when computers had these really clunky, you'll know this. You remember when computers had really clunky messages that would come up and it would be like this long string of numbers or something, and it would be like, you've got an error, but then it wouldn't tell you what the error was. And
yeah, I remember that.
So that was kind of the foundational thing behind user experience, was that was developers talking to other developers and telling them how to diagnose a problem with a computer. So UX kind of sprung out of that idea and said, well, why don't we put the user of the computer in focus rather than to ourselves. So there's three portions of there's the interactions on the site, there's the design, so the colors, and there's also the content. And so the core idea is that you need to give whoever's using the site content the right information at the right time in the right way so they can progress through whatever you're trying to take them through. It's exactly the same as what we do as coaches. We're not looking to be too advanced. We're not looking to be too we're looking to communicate with someone in a language that makes sense to them and say, you know, I want you to try this next, or can we do this in a different way? And so it's really helped me sharpen my empathy for people, because in content design, you have to figure out how to say something, how to do it. You have to go and research whether that works with people, whether you thought that you did. And then you got to factor in all sorts of inclusivity and accessibility content. So how does a blind user interact with what you're presenting to them, or how does someone who's dyslexic read the book? So it really sharpens your empathy and be like, yeah, there's a lot of things to factor in here to just get this, what I perceive to be a simple instruction across. And so I'm sure you can see naturally with coaching. It has helped in so many different ways. That's not just the written word.
Yeah, you must be. Do you go and watch other coaches coach much?
Yeah, as much as I can. And the benefit of being a national team coach is, yeah, you tend, particularly across Canada, you do get access.
Nice. You would be. You would find it, you would definitely be picking up on Rusty saying the word nice too much, and possibly using rugby jargon. It was interesting, actually. We did a webinar the other day and we had a couple of people on from other sports, and it just makes you aware that just how you use words that don't necessarily, people don't hear what you want them to hear.
Yeah, and for me, learning the other sports is hugely beneficial as well, or just watching other teams train others. I need to understand that language and that terminology anyway, because if a player from rugby comes to me, their natural thought process or how they move their body is going to be linked to that terminology. It's about basketball. If I want a player to put his hips in front of his defender, it's more akin to a center trying to grab a rebound than me trying to get it across in Aussie rules terminology. And so that's been really fortuitous for me as well. We get to, speak to the Canadian rugby guys or the Canadian basketball guys and say, yeah, how do you coach this movement, or how do you get them to do this?
So what I'm hearing you say is that because you have guys come from other sports, you might have guys come from hockey or basketball, you actually have to go and understand their world and their language, and then perhaps coach AFL using basketball terminology almost.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Like you think about someone that's come out of basketball or rugby and just how they process even movements, you know, it's going to be far more beneficial if I can explain, you know, if I'm trying to get one of my players in a marking contest to put his hips in front of his defender, but he comes from basketball, you know, that movement pattern is more akin to, you know, trying to grab a rebound in the key. So if I can go and speak to the coaches, learn that terminology, learn how that player or players in general in that sport would process that movement, that's where I think the rubber really hits the ground for my guys. And okay, yeah, I get that. Rather than me trying to talk in Aussie rules terminology that they're not familiar with, because then I'm just talking to myself. I'm trying to make myself feel good about how I'm coaching them rather than speaking to them in a language that they actually understand.
That was an Andy Friend quote there, talking to myself. I know you said earlier Friendy has some cool quotes, but that's definitely a quote I'm going to ask coaches a bit about. So what other sports have you been into? So it sounds, I mean, clearly your book will have involved some excursions into other sports. But what have you found in other sports?
Yeah, I mean, as you can imagine here in Canada, hockey is the big one. I thought Aussie rules was a religion until I saw ice hockey in Canada. And, you know, the joke here is that it's on the money, and it actually is. There's on the, I think it's the $5 bill, there's a whole little... yeah, hockey's a big one here, and I live about a block from where the Maple Leafs and the Raptors play, so... yeah, I get access to those guys, which is great. And the big North American sports, football, basketball, you know, there's just so many people in those industries that you can have conversations or ask questions about how they're coached.
What have you discovered? What's the best stuff? And I don't know whether any of it's incorporated in your book, but it's probably similar, like, what's the stuff on leadership you think people should know more about?
Well, I gravitate towards the coaches that I can see that are interested in the human being. And it's funny. So I've started writing a second book, Where Others Won't, came out in about 2017. And the concept behind that was more around competitive advantage. Whereas what I'm going to write about now is head coaching and the role of the head coach. And it's all about people. And it's funny though, because you go on to Amazon and you look at the top coaching books in every sport, soccer, rugby, American football, basketball, and they're all about X's and O's. But that's kind of the secondary piece. You can teach tactics all day long, but where I think I've learned the most from other coaches is that human connection and understanding of human behavior and behavior change. So I gravitate towards coaches that are interested in that talk about that. You know, you can see them on Twitter, the ones that are interested in the human beings rather than the coaches or the next rondo, and are open to having conversations about how we can all understand each other better, especially as the world becomes more global. There's so many more factors. You know, even thinking about how we motivate players and the language that we use around that, sometimes those things don't stick from other cultures. And we in the West particularly do a really bad job with that, just presuming that everyone had the same upbringing and the same association with teams and the same association with authority that we did in Australia and the UK. And that's just not the case.
What's different in North America?
Oh, I mean, in North America, it's very similar here. It's very, particularly in the United States, very kind of hard work, motivational. You see all the pump up videos on Instagram and things like that. Everyone in the weight room, and it's kind of very masculine and rah rah rah. But you have to factor in cultural differences now that we never really had to in the past, where guys from the Pacific Islands and their association with being part of a team or a collective rather than individualism, and how that might be different. Or you think about the association with authority for the Japanese culture as an example, and the respect that comes along with people that are older than you, and so that changes how you would teach or coach in a team environment. So there's things that as people keep moving around the world and we learn more about different cultures, like we have to factor that into our coaching rather than just having this broad strokes approach to everyone has to be on board with my style of coaching and our culture and the way we do things here. I just don't think that can continue at the pace that it's at the moment.
Yeah, nice. Suzanne Brown gave me a good, she just said, you haven't worked, when I was talking about a player I'd found hard to coach, she said, oh, you just haven't worked out how to coach him yet.
Yeah.
That was a great way of putting it. Just some other stuff I was thinking about while you were speaking there. Dan Leo came and did some stuff with us around Pacific Island kids, and actually, just some stuff that might be useful for us to know and to take into account when we're coaching.
And that's just human stuff, Rusty. Again, it's actually us that's done a bad job of educating ourselves on those cultural nuances. And, it goes further than that. It's, you might have a kid or a player that's constantly late to training. And so what we do is we tend to jump in and say, that's not how we do things, and you were late and I told you and all this sort of stuff. But, how about asking why they're late? Like, is there anything I can help you with? You get people that are catching two buses to training, or, they're actually the male figure in their household because the father passed away. And so they're picking up their little brother from school, or whatever the scenario is. Ask first. Is there something wrong? Is there something I can help you with? Rather than just jumping into discipline like we have for the last 80 years.
Laps, press-ups for the kid that's late. Pretty standard. Fare. Seek to understand first. When I find it hardest with my own son, if I'm honest. And my wife will tell me off because she'll say, look, you do this with other kids. But when you get emotional because it's your son, I'm often forgetting about the seek to understand bit.
That would be tough.
I was going to say, one of the best coaching experiences I ever had was coaching in Israel. So different, like just really different culturally. Like, tell us exactly what to do. We'll do it. Actually, like, real good challenge for me to see, if I can influence and nudge some stuff so that people can own their own decision making. But that would be a strong recommendation from me, that for people to do, as you are doing, really, just go and coach in a different country. Go and coach a different culture.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's one of the magic things about international Aussie rules is you see a lot of that. So you've got this game, and then you see these different cultures trying to solve that game. And so they all have, obviously the physiology is different. So you have different tactics based around that. But then also, all these different cultures and how they look at that one same problem is just fascinating. And I agree with you. I think I've been talking a lot about this on Twitter, coachability of players. And what we mean by that is we just want them to fall in line and not be difficult and not force us to have any sort of agility. The wrong way around. I think coachability is actually on us. We need to have the ability to coach and the agility to be able to coach different people. And I agree with you. I think getting out of your bubble and coaching or something teaches you that really quickly.
I was just writing stuff down. So the stuff I was thinking about then was, the reality for you is, can't imagine there's a million Aussie rules players in Canada. So But one of the things American sport does have at in American football and the likes is just you can afford to get it wrong as a coach because there's so many players. So actually you can't afford to be breaking eggs for fun, whereas actually, so some of the stuff we see, whilst we might not agree with it, they can almost get away with it versus a sport that doesn't have loads of, and by the way, I'm not saying that's right, but what I tend to see in those sports, that's often allowed a little bit more because they'll go, well, we've got some other people that can step up anyway.
Yeah, and the talent distribution at the professional levels is built that way too, which is why it's so fascinating teams like the New England Patriots or Seattle Seahawks or the Atlanta Falcons and how they have still said, no, we're going to build some psychological safety and some love into. And even though this guy might get cut and that's a reality of the game, we're going to love them while they're here, no matter what, and make them feel like insiders rather than outsiders. And it, honestly, it's that even in that cutthroat world, particularly North American sports, unguaranteed contracts, yeah, next man up kind of atmosphere, the teams that care more are the teams that win and win pretty regularly.
Who've you spoken to who's kind of got you really excited about this stuff? Who are your top two or three people that you say, look, these guys or girls, they're putting care and love at the centre of the thing?
Yeah, there's lots. I've had some really positive interviews for this book that I'm writing. I kind of give away who's in there, but it's been really exciting to learn more about this kind of stuff. But there's guys that, you know, even recently that have been on my podcast. Tony Granato he coached the Colorado Avalanche in the NHL in a couple of different stints. And you know, he used to play with Wayne Gretzky and you know, just an amazing career. And then just to hear him talk about, you know, one of the great teams in NHL history, really, and how it was just down to spending his time with them in their hotel rooms, talking to them. You know, this is back in the early 2000s. Just how I remove barriers from you. It just shows you that it doesn't matter the sport. It doesn't matter how complex you think it is. It doesn't matter where the people come from. Like, we're all in the people business. And that's why I think we can learn so much more from other sports and other disciplines around human behavior and human development, because we're all in the same thing. You might be a rugby coach and I'm an Aussie rules coach, but yeah, just levels, high school levels, we all deal with exactly the same challenges.
Yeah, you could definitely coach rugby as well as me, mate. It would be, you'd be fine at that. Why don't people think like this? That's the bit that I'm kind of wrestling with. I think it's, as you say, more and more information out there. Definitely an uprising on Twitter. Lots of successful coaches that would talk about it a lot. So Scott Robertson in rugby, Jackson, you know, and the kind of last dance stuff. Some of the people you've referenced there. What do you think's the reason people aren't doing it? Did you interview those people, by the way? That's the third book.
No, not those people. I think there's a little bit of a fear of going against the game at a certain sense, in that, you know, sometimes it's easy to just get caught up in what other people within our sport are doing and try, because you're trying to solve that problem. Maybe the time spent trying to learn from the outside isn't seen as valuable, but yeah, like, you know, I was listening to my mate, Nick Rutley, from back in Australia, on his podcast recently and talking to Neil about his role with Eddie Jones. And you know, part of that is being an outsider to rugby and the focus that he can have on just the team and making the team better and making Eddie better as an AFL coach. Like, he's not invested in the history of rugby or what it looks like or, you know, whether they're playing the 15s game properly. He's just, I'm better. And he doesn't care about all that stuff. So he has a real level of clarity in how he can work within that environment. And I think that's actually hits the nail on the head as to the benefit that it can bring to you. And yeah, even coaching the coaches, again, we tend to go back to someone who's been in the head coaching role within our sport because they can lend some input to the head coach. We should look at that kind of arrangement like Eddie has, where he's got an Aussie rules coach as his kind of right-hand man to bounce ideas off.
Yeah, to be fair to Craig, yeah, I think he's... And people, I think he's probably the most important hire that Eddie made. Naive expert, so he would understand performance, but he wouldn't be bogged down or clouded by the X's and the O's. So while everyone else is concerned about the X's and O's, he could probably have a bit more of a higher order view of everything from a bit more of a, you know, around principles around learning and performance and human development. And I just think it's, and he's just got no biases, quite frankly. And because he doesn't play the team and he doesn't understand the game, then he also has a really nice relationship with other people in the environment.
Yeah. And there's other examples of that. The one that stands out for me, Ralph Kruger, who was the chairman of Southampton for about 5 years, you know, through that pretty successful period where they had, you know, they brought players in like Virgil van Dijk and Mane and sold them on. But he was an ice hockey coach. Years before he took that chairman job, he was coaching Edmonton Oilers in the NHL. And so, again, you kind of have that outsider's perspective of, you know, the sport. And, you know, in speaking to him, he said, I still coach every single day. I now coach, you know, administrative staff and coaches and football people, but I still walk in and use the coaching philosophies that I was using with hockey players back in Edmonton. Yeah, that's why I keep coming back to this same theme, Rusty, of like, it's a people business and the actual subject matter doesn't matter as much as we think it does.
What's your headlines? So in the people business, and without giving away too much of your book, what's the two or three most important chapters? What would you want people to go? Here's some take-homes.
Yeah, the first one I think is just to kind of re-envision coaching as a service. We've gotten a little bit ahead of ourselves as a discipline or as a profession in terms of our importance. And, you know, I truly believe in, you know, the kind of servanthood idea. And I think some of us need a little bit of a reality check with regard to that. You know, we're there to serve the players.
What have you noticed?
Just the control and the, you know, these are my ideas and this is how we're going to play. And a lot of the time, you haven't even spoken to the players about that. So, you know, I think going forward, you know, co-creation of cultures is going to be really important, and having them have some skin in the game, the players, having them shape their own environment, and you kind of being a service provider to that is more important than the command and control style that, look, it worked and it was great. And I grew up in that style of Aussie rules, but I just don't see that being prevalent going forward. So maybe we do need a bit of a punch between the eyes and say, you know, we're here to serve the players, not the other way around. And then secondary to that would just be within coaching, particularly for men, you know, as we kind of go into this vulnerability, self-awareness phase of humanity, where, you know, we're kind of pushing towards that self-actualization in Maslow's hierarchy, if you believe in that or not. But we're not conditioned for that. You know, we were raised in the big boys don't cry era. And so, you know, there's a lot of reflection to be done for coaches in particular. And so I think that's going to be particularly important, because you often don't see, you don't like a lot of what you see when you actually do the deep work. And so I think, again, particularly for men in leadership roles, that's going to be important for us to start to delve into what we're dealing with so that we can be better coaches.
We'll come back to the third one in a second. Where have you seen that done well, and what's that look like? So people just becoming more aware and being willing to be more vulnerable.
I mean, it's a work in progress, right? It's still such a new concept. I think there are definitely some places doing it well. Obviously, most people watched the Chicago Bulls documentary, and you know, the Bulls are definitely ahead in terms of, you know, their meditation and mindfulness and things like that. But you know, you look at the San Antonio Spurs now, and they have a lot of that built into their programming. But again, I think it comes back to, at an individual level, having the bravery to go and dig into your own, you know, personal trauma and your own conditioning and your own finding somewhere to kind of leave that at the door, so that you're not, you know, pushing that trauma onto other people. You know, I sat through an absolutely fantastic presentation last year from the guy that was brought in to help the NBA Players Association, Coaches Association, sorry, with just that concept. Where do people get to leave their emotional baggage so that they can kind of be freed from it and, you know, bring themselves to work every day, and share actually who they are rather than being guarded? Really interesting concept, and something that, again, it's tough, and often you don't like what you see when you look in the mirror and do the hard work, but it can be freeing, and it will allow us to be better coaches.
Yeah. Who was that? Who delivered that?
I'd need to dig up his name, but there's some videos on YouTube. I'll send them to you, so we might be able to link in the show notes maybe, but it was just a fascinating kind of tale of, you know, what people deal with and how, particularly trauma, it doesn't need to be these big events in our lives, but often can be, and how it can kind of sit with you and then rear its head when you least expect it. Like it doesn't need to be something that is obvious. These things, particularly from childhood, can often reappear when you haven't thought about them for 20 years.
Oh, wow, that sounds cool. Well, I definitely have to get that in the notes.
Oh, yeah, I'll dig around for you and send them to you.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because you said, the way it was done to us worked, but actually, who's to say it has worked? You know what I mean? I'm still considering. I would still look back on lots of coaching that I wouldn't even necessarily call lots of coaching that I experienced, and it wasn't that helpful.
I guess it worked because we put up with it.
Yeah.
But other than that, yeah. But
and you're only comparing. Yeah. So if we're comparing rugby coaches, we're just comparing them with other rugby coaches. So we're not, you know, it's not like we're comparing them to the rest of the world. So there's actually quite a small number of people who hold the jobs, and it's just relative to the other people that you're being compared, really.
That's very true, yeah. But I don't know do you think there's a changing landscape in coaching from what you can see in terms of that, in terms of the, you know, this reflection, awareness, vulnerability phase?
See, it's probably a development level. I would see some good examples of it. So we've chatted about Andy Friend, or Chris Boyd at Northampton Saints, I would see some isolated examples of it. Actually, we'll go to your third thing and then we'll talk about head coaches and assistant coaches. I actually see assistant coaches that really want to, you know, change the world, but they're somewhat limited by head coaches. And I kind of guess, I get some of the reasons why. So, yeah, maybe, and also I guess because I'm in a bubble of people like me and they're kind of self-selecting, and I would see quite a bit of it, but I see frustration amongst lots of those people that it's not universal and that they're often having to respond to someone who thinks it's pink and fluffy and not that important or relevant. So I see people actually that get really frustrated as coaches because they kind of see what's possible. And the same with players who've had, you know, who often transition into first teams and then go, right, is this it? Like, okay, I'm now, my skill is now regressing. So I do see it and I see lots of opportunities, and I'm intrigued as to the impact of lockdown because we've all had time to reflect and think and gather some information and perhaps get some feedback from some people and listen to some other people talk about stuff that we maybe just didn't know that we didn't know. So I'm really intrigued as to what it looks like when we go back.
Yeah, me too. And that's why I think it's going to be really interesting. And this has kind of catapulted us into that a little bit more. And whether you're prepared for it or not, I think you're going to get it, because that's been the conversations I've been having with other coaches that has been around. Yeah, just the challenges of dealing with this, you know, vulnerability and we've just been catapulted in, and it's going to be sink or swim, I think.
So I had a chat to a coach who's in the Premiership, and he suggested to the head coach, let's spend a bit of time on Zoom getting to understand our players. He said I was met with silence, which is interesting. Why wouldn't you understand, you know, why wouldn't you get to know your players? What's the benefit of not knowing your players? So I'm genuinely curious as to what it looks like. Now, the other thing that I'm aware of that I'm thinking a bit about is, so Andy Abraham did a brilliant, and Gary did a brilliant webinar on Friday for UK coaching. And they spoke about that moment, like the fog as a coach, where you kind of suddenly realise there's lots of stuff I don't know. And actually, I'm going to, you know, it's not as binary as I used to think it was, and it depends, and I've got to actually start to think a bit more about my decision making and who kind of guides you in the fog. So I think even if there's coaches that want to learn and progress and go into the fog, I don't think they have people with them to help them. So often and it might have been something that's come about, and perhaps once again the people you're speaking to are self-selecting. Often what I notice in business and sport is the people at the top have the least amount of support, and they have the least amount of people that can be honest to them. And so it's harder for them.
100%. That is the pure reason for me writing this next book, is that the infrastructure around particularly head coaches just isn't there, and it isn't there to the level that it needs to be. And there's a whole range of reasons for that. It's not about applying blame, but the speed of change in professional sport, especially in the last 20 years, has been astronomical. And so, yeah, this pause has given us an opportunity to say, yeah, these support structures around these people aren't adequate for what they need to know and deal with.
Yeah. So we're going to pick up on that. Tell me the third thing. So vulnerability was the second thing. What was the third thing?
The third thing, mate, and there's more than three things, but the one that I would say is probably going to be the most punchy would just be recruiting. We talk endlessly about culture, but we don't talk or put any credence or time or effort into the gateway to that culture. So who you let in the door and who you show the door is probably the most important thing to your culture. Not the words on the wall and the, you know, the reflection, you know, let's call ourselves resilient and ruthless and all this sort of stuff. Honestly, you know, again, anyone can come up with that, but it's that knock-on effect. Who do we filter in and out of our environment? That needs a lot more time and energy put into it across the board, business, sport, you name it.
So little effort put into it, in my experience.
So little effort. Think about this, Rusty. Let's use a business example. Every organization on the face of the planet will tell you how different they are. We're different. You know, McDonald's is different from Burger King, and or Coke's different from Pepsi. And then you spend 2 minutes on LinkedIn and they all have exactly the same job description. Exactly the same. It is laid out in exactly the same way.
My job description kill me. They kill me.
Every single organization on the face of the planet has exactly the same job description. So tell me how much effort is being put into recruiting and understanding your culture and adapting and actually showing up with something that's representative of your culture.
Yeah, and in professional sports especially, lots of jobs don't get advertised. We limit choice by putting on stuff that makes it impossible for lots of people to apply. So football, soccer's the classic. You need a UEFA or UEFA B. I said, I work with Fletch, and someone said to me, oh, here's our job advert. I said, oh, could John Fletcher do your job? They said, oh, yeah, he'd be brilliant. I was like, he hasn't got any football qualifications. So you've already precluded him. And then it looks the same. The interview is often a stressful experience. You possibly don't see the best of people. It's too short. It's not longitudinal enough. It doesn't involve behavioural type of stuff. So
that's context.
Yeah. I'd probably just put it, and you probably got a better chance of just putting some litter on the floor and giving the job to whoever picks up the most litter. So that would, for me, I'd probably get a reasonable human if that was the case.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I've read up a lot about the NFL head coaching process and the fact that they can make hires. Granted, they'll spend, you know, 8 or 10 hours kind of locked away going through all sorts of things. But even then, if that's your only interaction with someone and then you're trusting them with all of your multi-million dollar players and giving them a 5-year, $25 million coaching deal after just going through a binder with them, I don't know. I'm not sure that's necessarily the best way, spending one day together and being like, all right, you're in. So there's, you know, I really want to unpack that and what that could look like. And but again, I just keep coming back to this idea of we talk endlessly about culture, but who you let in and who you let go is the most important thing. And that's actually your culture, not what you've decided to label yourself.
My top recommend is to watch the Heineken YouTube, The Interview. I don't know if you've seen it. My top recommend. That's what I think interviews should look like. At least something like that, where you get to understand people's character a little bit more.
I agree. I have seen it. It's class.
Yeah, that's good. That's a whole podcast in itself. I'm actually doing a bit of work with Tyler Grange around this, and we've done some really cool stuff around. And actually, I mean, A, it's better performance. B, it's cheaper in the long run because you have to get rid of less people. It's really important. So there's your top three. There's lots more. That's good. Let's go. Head coach, assistant coach. What have you noticed?
The difference?
Yeah, different similarities.
I mean, it's a completely different job. I think a head coach now in the professional ranks of any sport is more akin to a CEO in terms of actually managing departments and, you know, spending their time doing things other than coaching. And I think just the other thing to realize is that as much as you don't think you've necessarily changed when you go from an assistant to a head coach, everyone else perceives that you've changed because your job title has changed. So, you know, for instance, if you went from assistant to head coach within the same team. You know, you'd be buddy buddy with the lads as an assistant coach. You know, you probably sneak down for a pint with them, you know, just to make sure everyone's okay, but you're more of a friend. And then the second that you go to head coach and it's just a change of title, you walking in the room, in the locker room, you know, just changes their demeanor. You know, the head coach is in the room now. And so I think we need to realize a lot of those things. You don't think you've changed and you might not change a lot of what you do, but that title change makes other people respond differently to you. And so you need to be aware of that and prepared for that. And that's before you get to, you know, the realities of the job, the moving around the world and the or moving your family around or your kids reading about you in the newspaper or whatever it may be, before you even get into that stuff.
Yeah, the judgments in the press, especially at the top end of the game, are something I wouldn't be that excited about, if I'm brutally honest. I said to you earlier, I just prefer being an assistant coach. I think it suits my skill set better. I've done both, but I'm with you. You end up moving away from the stuff that you love. And I have lots of conversations with coaches. I think it's a useful experience for them because it's useful to understand the differences and experience some of that stuff. What's been your experience of it? So have you got assistant coaches with Canada?
Yeah, I've got four assistants. I've got two Aussies who have, you know, great tactical knowledge that is superior to mine, and they love doing that kind of stuff. And then I've also got two Canadian-born assistants who've got into coaching. And I think it's important for us, you know, part of my job isn't just our team performance, it's the development of the sport in the country. And you know, Canadians have to own that. And so if they can't get into coaching positions and understand the game from the coaching perspective, then we're not really leaving a legacy for the sport. So yeah, I've got four, which again, you know, that's part of it. Now I manage four people as well as try to coach the team and pass on my expertise.
Were you previously assistant or were you get straight into the head honcho?
Yeah, I was an assistant at first. So I was, I spent a couple of years, Ben Roberts was the head coach and we were good mates and we got along perfectly and complimented each other. So that was a great arrangement. But yeah, I've seen the difference between, you know, moving within the same team, even from assistant to head coach, and how that changes people's interactions with you.
Did it change you?
Yes. Yeah, no doubt. It puts you in the spotlight so much more, and you have to be prepared for that. You know, people want answers out of you and they want to know what to do, and your time. You know, one of the best things that was said to me recently was, as a head coach, to you it might be 10 minutes, but to them it might be the most important 10 minutes of their day. And that probably sums up the difference for you right there in a simple little sentence. You have to understand that you kind of get this like another person knocking at my door. You've got a question as well. Well, the other 20 people have had questions for me as well, and I'm trying to send this email and I've got a press conference coming up, but that might be the most important 10 minutes of that person's day. And so you have to create the time for them, create the space for you to be there with them and actually present with them. You don't have that sort of pull on your time and energy as an assistant.
Yeah, I can vouch for that. Have you noticed anything change around your body language? Are you aware of that stuff or not?
Oh, constantly, because you have to be. You got to show up every day. There's no other option. Now, you were talking about being a parent earlier, and I'm not a parent, but I think it's the same kind of idea of you have to show the way. You have to, walk in positively. You've got your own shit going on in your life, but you can't bring that into work. And so I'm very cognizant of that.
Something I noticed, so with England under 20s, they used to do kind of like a job rotation, and different weeks they'd be a head coach. And I would actually notice people would go from, like, as you said, like being one of the lads, to walking around with their hands behind their back, like that. It's just a change of title, like 10 minutes earlier. And you put your hands behind your back and you put your chest out. And maybe that was the being present bit, but it was just really intriguing to see that there's some expectations of how a head coach might act.
Yeah. And that's part of it too, isn't it? Like that is inherent in kind of the game and in humans, you know, changing roles and how that does change your personality or your behaviors or your demeanor. And I think for the most part, it's just that awareness of it. And so, you know, there's a whole range of different things you can do to learn about yourself, you know, videotaping meetings and watching yourself and how you present to the group, things like that. You can just...
Are you doing a lot of videoing of yourself?
I haven't, we don't have that kind of resource, but that's why even... a podcast has been great. I get to listen to myself talk to other people for an hour, you know, 60 times over, which is confronting because you always hate the sound of your own voice. But there's little, there's even little things like that where you learn something about yourself. It could be something that you say repetitively, which I notice when I listen to myself on the podcast. But again, that feeds into how you approach coaching and trying to get better every day.
Nice. My trick is to give it to your wife. She tells you pretty quickly what you're doing wrong.
100%. 100%.
Hopefully she won't hear this one. And what have you, for your latest book, you've been kind of interviewing head coaches from around the world, different sports. Same again, what's in your hand luggage? What's your top two or three things that you think people would want to hear?
Yeah, well, I mean, those three that we went over were kind of infused in there for sure. I'd say the one that I've been focusing on the most recently that might be useful is just that kind of authenticity piece or understanding yourself. Which we've kind of been talking about a little bit here, but you know, I feel like to merge these ideas together is what you were saying before. Is it's so easy to just go into what you think a head coach should act like, or how you think the game should be played, or just you kind of become conditioned by the game or the atmosphere. And I think where we can really push ourselves forward is by having the bravery to kind of go against the game a little bit. And so, I think this tactic could work, or I think this cultural element could work, or, you know, not copying other people and actually saying, well, you know, if this is my one shot and I don't get another shot to be the head coach, I want to die on this hill. You know, I think this idea can work in our sport or in team sport or whatever it may be. I think we can push ourselves a little bit more.
Yeah, the Brian Clough speaks about, I think he got sacked about 4 months into his first ever coaching job, but as a result, he got paid out by 4 years. So he called it his, excuse my French, his fuck off money. So he knew that at that point, he could do what he thought was the right thing and he could walk away if he needed to. I think that's often the challenge of, is also that you're paying your mortgage. And yet the flip of it is, so Leeds United just got promoted to the Premier League, first time in 16 years, and Bielsa, Leeds are playing different football to everyone else in the league. Well, no one else is even training against it. So how are they going to beat it?
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and so the question becomes, well, how do you fast track that without either having the fuck off money to not care, or having won, you know, like Bielsa everywhere around the world, so he kind of has some comfortable pathways, and would get a job within 2 seconds if he lost his job at Leeds. You know, so I, again, it takes bravery, and it's going to be tough for a lot of people. But yeah, I think how do we get coaches early on in their careers to be open and willing to play the way they want to play, rather than just going with the game?
How do we? What's the stuff that people have spoken to you about that's been useful for them?
Well, there aren't that many that have done it, mate, because again, there's realities of the game, and you, yeah, at the moment, the reality is you just have to win. There aren't enough organizations that have that, that are, you know, committed to coaches. The system is definitely not beneficial to that, in that, you know, guaranteed contracts aren't a thing, and you know, you could win a couple of games and still get fired. You could have a crazy owner, you could, all these different things. But yeah, there aren't too many that have it. They just understand that they need to win, so they go into win mode straight away, which buys you time, which buys you goodwill to be able to implement some of those things that you might want to do. But I don't know, there just has to be a better way. There has to be more security somewhere. There has to be organizations that genuinely are willing to go through with the 3-year contract or 4-year contract. There's just a better way, mate. And so I'm trying to normalize these conversations so that hopefully organizations read the book and go, actually, there is a better way here. We can't be Watford and have 3 coaches in the same season. It's just, that can't be the best way.
There's no way it's the best way.
There is no way it's the best way.
Yeah, well, whenever I go into a sport, I kind of try and find out where are the pioneers. And I'm often met with a blank face.
Mm.
I think lots of things would be going against it. Another question I was going to ask is, you kind of touched on it then with Bielsa, was like credibility. So I've spoken to a couple of assistant coaches or coaches who weren't top level players, and they've applied for jobs, they haven't got the job, but the feedback they've been given is around credibility and that type of stuff. What are your thoughts around that?
I mean, it's really contextual on the sport. I, as someone who didn't make it the professional grade, I tend to think there's a better way. and I think it's, you know, assessing on the merit of what someone brings to the table right now. I often talk about, you know, I think Belichick played Division III college. Popovich played at the Air Force Academy. You know, Joe Madden, I think, never got above single A baseball. So you can continue to go down the line. I think Julian Nagelsmann now at Red Bull. I wrote about him in my book, and he was 28, 29 when he got the job, and had never played professionally. He was out, you know, by the time he was 19 or 20 with knee injuries. Muhammad Ali's trainer never fought in a fight. So you can keep going down the line, and I have these examples racked up. How long do you want to go, Rusty? What does this person bring to us right now? Are they making good decisions as a coach right now? Not did they play in a grand final in front of 100,000 people? Because I can, the coach that we all look to as probably the premier coach in the world right now has got 6 Super Bowls. He doesn't know what it's like to block an NFL lineman, and he doesn't know what it's like to throw a pass in the NFL. He is the premier example of what we're all kind of striving towards, and he was never there. So yeah, just, I don't know, don't sit there and tell me that's the one pathway into coaching. It's just, that's bollocks.
I agree. You might need to tell some rugby owners. It's interesting. I mean, I almost tweeted it today, but I thought I just get grief if I tweet it, if I'm honest. I will tweet it later. But no player has ever said to me, we want an ex-player to coach us. No player's ever said that. They've said we want really good coaches that'll challenge us and stretch us and push us and support us and trust us and all of those things. No one's ever said I want Motley Cup International, yet I still, you know, in my old job with England, someone came into the pathway and that's what he said. He said only ex-international players should coach.
Yeah.
But that's not what the players are asking for. It's not what they need or want.
No. But again, there's to kind of go full circle with this is, we were talking about this earlier, no one goes and asks the players.
Perhaps.
Maybe. But, yeah. You know, hey, I'm an Aussie rules coach, but I'm from Canberra originally. And so I grew up with rugby league. Like the Canberra Raiders were everything to me as a kid. And so I watched, you know, the formation of the Brumbies and all of that. And so that's actually my native sport. So, I've been in and around elite level sport. I reckon I could do okay in the rugby scene, you know, because I can go and find a technical coach. There's going to be a million brilliant technical coaches, but that's not the job anymore. Like it's go and find a technical coach, let them thrive, go and ask the players what they want, how we can be of service to them. And that's the game. So
nice. Next 12 months, what's your hopes? What's the hopes for you and for coaching?
I hope that we continue to make time for the learning that we've had. I hope the lockdown has shown us that it's worth talking to coaches from other sport or, you know, having a little support group for yourself and actually protecting time for that and not going back to the rat race.
I'm with you on that. I really, really hope we don't get back on the hamster wheel. What about you personally? Obviously, you're not going to get to go to your world champs or your international tournaments.
Yeah, so book for me is the next challenge and hopefully get that out this year. And then, yeah, we load up again for, it'll be July 2021. And fingers crossed we get to go there. But other than that, it's just contingency planning. So if we don't get to fly to Australia, how do we get games or how do we continue to move our program forward? So, I mean, the great thing about sport is there's always challenges and that it always throws up something new. And this isn't my preferred new, but it's the reality of it. And so, if we end up going to Europe and just playing a little tournament there or playing the US, yeah, it's just how do we continue to move the ball forward for our guys?
No, it's cool. And I just got a couple of one-worders. I'm mindful of your time. AFL.
Do I have to answer with one word?
I'll give you two.
The greatest.
Canada.
Cold.
It is cold. It's ridiculous. Like, so cold.
Oh, mate. Having to put on multiple pairs of pants and like five sweaters and then a jacket. You've got no idea. It is so cold.
The guy tied for 5 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. To run and get milk.
Australia.
Home.
Leadership.
Messy.
Nice, I like that. That's probably my favourite leadership answer. Coaching.
Rewarding.
Nice. Cody Royal, where can people find you? King of Twitter, aren't you? You are all over Twitter.
I love Twitter. I'm a writer by trade, so I'm more Twitter than Instagram. I can't take pictures to save my life. My poor wife actually has to put up with my shoddy pictures. So yeah, Twitter, CodyRoyal.com has all of my stuff, the podcast, the book, my contact details, everything there.
Mate, it's been a pleasure. I've loved it. You've got to go. Have a great day and we'll speak soon.
Thanks, Rusty. Appreciate it, mate.